Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Actress Jane Kaczmarek is best known for playing the character of Lois on the hit TV series Malcolm in the Middle. She is a 3-time Golden Globe and 7-time Emmy Award nominee. Currently, she is starring in the very funny Williamstown Theater Festival production of Sharon Rothstein's Tell Me I'm Not Crazy. Forced into retirement and unsettled by the changing world around him, Saul buys himself a gun. His family, then, is not happy about this. His wife, Diana, played by Jane, said they'd rather spend more time together and, you know, spend time with the grandkids. But Saul's new hobby certainly literally puts a bullet in that plan. Meanwhile, their son, Nate, is trying to be a good stay-at-home dad while his wife is climbing the corporate ladder and school is calling with concerns about their child. Tell Me I'm Not Crazy is a world premiere comedy. It's playing on the festival's Nikos stage through August 3rd, and we welcome our very good friend Jane Kaczmarek back to the roundtable. How are you, Jane?
Hello, Joe and everybody. I love you guys. I'm very well, thank you. Working at Williamstown, you know, this is my 6th season here, and it's really kind of a ruse because I just want to come back to my house in Northwest Connecticut, and so I get the best of both worlds. I get to be in Connecticut and come up to Williamstown and work.
It is well, I saw the show last night, and it is just
Oh, man.
It is funny as all get out. You are marvelous. And what a blast. I will tell you something. I saw the show and then I immediately left the theater, got in my car and turned on CNN to listen to the debate. What a great appetizer your show is for that debate.
Wow. I hadn't thought of that. Well, thank you. And everyone should come and see it. This is we're finishing on Saturday, but, you know, there are a lot of ideas crammed into that into the play. Tell me I'm not crazy. And I'm not sure. It's very courageous of this playwright to do this because it's very funny and it's very serious and it goes back and forth. And sometimes it's a little unsettling to know what the tone is. But that's probably a good way to describe what's going on in America right now anyway. It's really hard to find the tone. Well, actually, it's not. I think we've all discovered the tone.
Right.
And trying to figure out how we're going to go forward. But it's been interesting. We're, you know, Mark Blum, who plays my husband, is we did a Neil Simon comedy on Broadway in 1991, Lost in Yonkers. And working with him again is just wonderful. Because we get to be, there's a lot of fun happens between us, but also the serious scenes about really growing older and looking forward in life and thinking, wow, this, I'm looking ahead to what lies ahead. And Diana has some great lines at the end about don't be scared. Don't throw away the third act. It's the best
right.
part of the play.
It's beautiful.
That I just love. And I'm at that point in my life too. My kids, daughter lives in Chicago as a dancer. I'm taking to college in a couple of weeks. And then I have one at home and you can't believe you're really at that point of looking at your third act. And this play is very encouraging about, you know, is the glass half empty? Is the cartridge on the gun half empty or half full? That's kind of some dark humor, but
you know, the thing that struck me is that it seems I was struck almost immediately by this fact that because the show just starts out this way where Mark's character just walks in and we learn that he's purchased a gun and. You don't, I mean, I don't have a gun. I've never had a gun. I've never shot a gun. But you can completely understand why that would upend just about everything. I mean, that's completely plausible.
Yeah. I don't have a problem with people having guns.
Nor do I.
I mean,
as long as I don't have to hold one.
Well, right. And as long as it's, you know, unless...
And it's
legal.
You know,
I think about my house with... Living in California most of the year, you know, if you have a swimming pool, your insurance goes up. If you have a diving board in your swimming pool, you know, your insurance goes way up. You know, having a gun in your house should be reflected in all sorts of safety measures to take care of it. And I think that's the thing we're seeing that is just wildly out of control in this country. But I do think of what it would be like to walk into your house and have your husband holding a firearm, especially the kind of family we are, where it just seems so out of nature. But I understand where that guy's coming from. And the part that fear plays in everyone's life, especially as you're growing older, about the thought of being in control when there's no such thing really in life, which is a good thing for us all to embrace.
Now, very early in the show, as he comes in with a gun and presents this to you, his wife, your first reaction is, hey, you're the guy who stapled your thumb to the to the wall. I mean, should you be having a gun?
Well, and it's kind of set too in the, how could you have a, you know, who the hell would give you a real gun? Who would let you buy a real gun? You can't have a gun because you want, you know, it's not. Why did you get it? It's like, who would let you have you of all people? which is, I'm sure, a rather comic way of looking about how people do get guns, how easily they get guns. I mean, that's a whole other topic we can face in their time. But it's a really interesting. I mean, when people say, what was the play about? The 25 word or less than 10, I say it's a comedy about gun control, which is like, what? I think it's a kind of an interesting way to bring up the subject without banging people over the head with, all the rhetoric that we've heard, and makes perfect sense. But to have people who might be on the other side of the equation, see it presented in a different point of view than just what is usually screamed at us from whatever side you're listening to.
Also very much a family story between not only do we meet you and your husband, we also meet your son and his wife in the show, and they're going through their own set of problems. One of those problems being that they have a child who is 3 years old, having some difficulties at daycare. And, they would send him to Grandma and Grandpa's house, but Grandpa's got a gun.
Yeah. That's a interesting thing, isn't it? I remember when my children were little, going to my parents' house in Milwaukee, and my father always had Bill O'Reilly on and a Fox News, and look, my kids would just be sitting there, and I'd pick them up, and I would just say, "Come on, guys, I'm going to go in the other room," and my father, "Well, there's nothing wrong with all this kind of stuff," but I just didn't want them to be subjected to that, the fierceness of the hate mongering that I would hear on those shows. And I understand this young, the mother says she had grown up with guns and there was an accident with the neighbor. And she just says her kids to be around guns, which I think is a really understandable thing. I know when my kids were growing up, too, other parents would ask if you had a gun before the kid could come over for a play date. The only way your kid is going to get shot is if there's a gun in somebody's house. So it's a pretty black and white way to know where your kid's going to play.
Yeah, absolutely. The show. My understanding is, in reading in the program notes last night. So you have been attached and have been part of this for a little while.
Well, we did a reading of it last summer, and I went up to Mandy afterwards. Mandy
Greenfield.
Yep. Oh God, I'm sorry. Who had asked me to play it, and I said, "What's going on with this play? Where does this go next?" And she said, "Well, we commissioned it." And I said, "This is a project I really want to be attached to." And then you kind of start thinking about the cast. Mark turned out to be the perfect guy to play this because Mark Blum. And it all came around during the year. We did a couple more readings. Sharon did a couple more rewrites. Frankly, rewrites were going on throughout the rehearsals. Which is tough, not so much my lines, but Mark Blum, who plays Saul, my husband, had a lot of rewrites. And there was a lot of talk about how much the playwright should be bringing up. The other couple, the young couple, there are many layers of issues in that marriage that are touched upon. And we did one version of it where that stuff was really pared down. And then it all came back in. And so it's interesting. Yeah, I'm on the board of the Pasadena Playhouse out in Pasadena, which is a fabulous theater with a new artistic director. And I'm hoping, knock on wood, that we can do it out in Pasadena where I can walk to work. How many people can say that in Los Angeles?
It's all about convenience at this point, isn't it? You just walk out of the house, do a show, everything's fine.
Oh, man, Pasadena is like this little liberal arts college in the middle of Southern California. The Conservatory of Music, the Pasadena Playhouse. I'm on the board of the Educational Foundation, Enhancing Public Schools. Williamstown, a couple of years ago, I did a play with Alfred Molina, and it just shook me to the core thinking about what I was doing with my life and realized theater makes me happier than anything. I feel so fulfilled, and I love working with theater artists. And I called I got rid of my agent at 25 years and called the new ones and said, I don't want to do TV. I want to concentrate on theater and raising my kids. So I've been very lucky to come back to Williamstown the last couple of summers and do another play in the wintertime back in California. But then I'm home with my kids and in Pasadena, my great community, working in public schools with the kids. And life could not be better. Well, it could, depending on who we elect as the next president.
Good.
But other than that.
Good point.
Between the Berkshires and Pasadena, life is good.
So I would lose my talk show host license if I didn't ask you what it was about And No More Shall We Part with Alfred Molina that shook you to your core.
Did you see that? You know,
I did.
Character was dying, and
yeah.
It was basically, and I wanted to go before the cancer took me. And Fred's character, you know, was like, if you love me, you won't commit suicide. And my character was, if you love me, you'll let me commit suicide. And this director, Annie Kaufman, was so right about me never showing what she called my tender underside. She said, you have to be positive. You have to make your husband know you are absolutely secure in your decision to do that. And I kept saying, but I'm the one who's dying. Why can't I cry? And she said, no, 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 no. And the dynamic of that was so powerful because going through that play with him falling apart repeatedly and me saying, no, this is the right thing to do. There's that beautiful moment at the end when we're having our last dinner together and I'm going to take the pills at the end of dinner. And he helps me up to take me. I've taken the pills to go to the bedroom and lie down. And my character completely falls apart, sobbing. And as an actress, I so trusted this director. It paid off in such a huge, huge way that I felt just revitalized as an actress. And also the set designer, Rachel Houck, and the lighting designer, everything about that, I thought, this is this tiny intimate play. Why is this set so massive and lonely? And she said, because we want the audience to be aware of when you die and you're gone, your husband is going to be in this huge empty house. And that loneliness will be present throughout the play. And I thought, the thought, the artistry, everything that went into putting this play on, it was like, there's a great T.S. Eliot poem that ends with, and the end of all our wandering will be to arrive at the place we started and know it for the very first time. And that's exactly what I thought. I thought I was like 15 years old again in the high school play and the top of my head blew off. I just knew I wanted to do this. So I cut myself loose from a lot of things that I had been doing. I mean, television has been very, very good to me, but I didn't want to continue in that world. I feel more at home with theater artists. You can make Chekhov jokes, and you really can't do that in television.
Well, you can make them, just nobody will understand them.
And I'm lucky. I mean, I'm very grateful to television that I was very, very lucky, and I saved my shekels, as my father says, and can really do what my life now, what I want to do. So I'm looking forward to coming to Albany and go to the Herman Melville Museum, I understand, is there?
I think that's in
Pittsfield or Albany.
Yeah, well, we're in Lenox, is Arrowhead.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, because I did Selected Shorts up in Albany this winter.
That's right, at the New York State Writers. Yeah.
Oh, my God, what a great group of people.
Yeah.
They were one of the best audiences I've ever had in selected shorts, and I've been doing it for so many years around the country. They were smart. They were writers. They were listeners. They were just fantastic. Also, that school was beautiful. I've never been up there before.
It's gorgeous.
That was really wonderful.
You know, and I was just thinking, because isn't it interesting, and maybe this is a stretch, I don't know, but both you and your co-star in Malcolm in the Middle, Bryan Cranston, who has also done very well on television, but has just finished up a very successful run on Broadway and in the theater, and boy, his some of his great work is being done on stage.
Yeah. The collaboration is... unlike, you know, television is all filmed out of sequence. You know, Malcolm, when we did Malcolm, we never rehearsed. We had our stand-ins would do the blocking with the camera. We'd be in hair and makeup, and we'd come in, and your stand-in would say, okay, cross to the toaster on this line, cross here on this line. And, you know, that's how you put it, because you had so much you had to get done so quickly. Also, with children, you know, those little boys on Malcolm when we started, even when we ended, they can work very, very few hours in a day. So we would film the kids' coverage, and then when they'd turn around to film me, they would bring in the kids' stand-ins, who were little people, grown men who were little people. So I would sometimes be talking to what should have been Dewey, and it was a fully bearded man, you know, who was 4'10". And I'd be doing my scenes with him because as an adult, they could work longer hours than the kids. Does that make sense?
It does. No, that's like a true Hollywood story. I want to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is fascinating.
Yeah. So, you know, it was an amusing time. But it really didn't bring the kind of satisfaction.
Are you saying, does it just get down to the point that the stand-in for Dewey didn't get your Chekhov joke? Is that really what it gets down to?
Yes. But it was a fascinating experience to meet a wonderful community of little people who really work frequently as stand-ins for children. Kevin and... I forgot his wife's name. We're a married couple who and had one son who was a I don't want to say regular sized person, but he was not a little person.
Yes.
And you know, you think about it was very interesting being in a community like that and thinking about how their lives were affected by their size and the way people treated them and just what their kitchens looked like, you know. Have to be short. It was a wonderful, wonderful time.
So I have
many other reasons than acting.
I have two quick observations. One is that, man, wouldn't that be a great show? Just to, like, that community, tap into that for a show.
You know what? Because when the Munchkins were used on The Wizard of Oz, you know, they didn't even let them come to the premiere of the movie.
I know.
Because they were considered, you know, it's unbelievable. It's just...
And the second observation,
that is a very...
the second observation I was going to make is we started talking about gun control.
Yeah, and here we are in Munchkins.
Well, it is. I can't tell people how much I enjoyed the show, and I know there are limited tickets, so I hope people get a chance to see it. It is Tell Me I'm Not Crazy. It's a world premiere comedy. It's playing on the Williamstown Theater Festival's Nico stage. It's through August 3rd. And what did you say? It's a comedy about gun control.
Yeah, that kind of gets people's attention.
It certainly does.
But, you know, Joe, I wanted to thank you also. You played an interview with Phil Donahue.
Yes.
A while ago.
I did.
That is one of the greatest things to remember, just a time of such common sense in those interview shows, how he handled that, the blazing common sense of someone like Phil Donahue in this day and age. I was so moved by that and remembered how much I loved that guy. I really appreciated hearing that again. Well, where can I get
you.
Actually, where how can I hear that?
It's
again,
online.
Actually?
It's online.
It
if
is.
You put Joe Donahue and Phil Donahue in the search engine, it'll come up.
Ah. Oh yeah, because and my birthday, Phil Donahue and I share a birthday.
Well, it's very cool.
Also, a love of that girl. So he's a real favorite of mine.
Yeah, absolutely. Mine too. And I'm thank you so much. I that was a great thrill. I always love talking to you. It is Jane Kaczmarek in Tell Me I'm Not Crazy. It's playing through August 3rd. Jane, thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe. I'll talk to you again soon.
Be well. I look forward to it. Thank you.
Okay.